The Tom Woods Show, episode 954.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Folks, check out the titles of these intriguing books. 14 Hard Questions for Libertarians Answered. Education Without the State. Your Facebook Friends Are Wrong About Healthcare. And Bernie Sanders is Wrong. What do these books have in common? They're all free at tomsfreebooks.com. Hi, everybody. Tom Woods here. There's been some controversy about a recent book by a woman named Nancy McLean. It's called Democracy in Chains, The Deep History of the Radical Right's Stealth Plan for America. And it's one of these books that makes no distinctions of any kind. As far as she's concerned, Bob Dole, Newt Gingrich, Pat Buchanan, Donald Trump, Murray Rothbard, and Milton Friedman are more or less all the same person. So it's about what you expect from the left when they examine us. But we're pretty good at making distinctions on their side. I pretty much know who the different groups are. But man, we are all the same somehow. Well, anyway, it's the book has been savaged so far, at least on our side, because we've dug out facts that obviously contradict what's being said here. In fact, I think probably the best job I've seen done on this so far is by Tom DiLorenzo, who has an article, a review of it, coming out in the Quarterly Journal of Austrian Economics, the print edition of which is not yet available, but the online version is, and I will be linking to Tom's review at tomwoods.com/954. No doubt you know Tom DiLorenzo. He's a professor of economics at Loyola University in Baltimore. He's the author of many books, most recently, The Problem with Socialism. Tom, welcome to the show.
Please be with you again, Tom.
All right, I just told everybody about the Nancy McLean book, and you've smashed it. Smashing this thing has become an interesting pastime for people our friend Phil Magnus, for example, and David Gordon has written against it. And then other people whose paths we don't cross all that often are spending a lot of time attacking it as well. You knew James Buchanan, didn't you?
Yes, I was a student of James Buchanan's at VPI, Virginia Polytechnic Institute, in graduate school. In the 1977, I took his public finance course. And I saw him almost every day for 3 years in graduate school at VPI.
All right. So you were sort of in a position, given that you knew him personally, and secondly, that you've read almost everything there is to read, presumably, in these areas, and you've been in libertarianism for a long time, certainly enough to know that regardless of what claims Nancy McLean is going to make about him, and we'll get to those in a minute, whatever the scope of his achievements were, I don't know of anybody who, looking through the annals of libertarianism as a school of thought, thinks James Buchanan. I just don't see that. I don't think he even thought of himself that way.
No, he was sort of a fellow traveler. And his work was once described by his colleague Victor Vanberg as creating a theory of a voluntary theory of the state. And that's really at odds with a lot of libertarianism, as you know, Tom, that, there's nothing voluntary about the states, about government. But that was Buchanan's enterprise. And then he was sort of a very wide-ranging scholar. He did a lot of good things in applied microeconomics, just analyzing government regulations and things like that, public finance. But his main enterprise was this theorizing about how the state really is voluntary after all. And it's called constitutional economics. It was sort of a branch of public choice.
Okay. And I don't know if the explain public choice briefly, just so we can say we've covered it.
Well, microeconomics is basically a study of incentives, of human incentives. And when we teach it, we teach about the incentives that consumers have in responding to price changes and things like that, what incentives businesses have, what incentives anybody has in the economic world. And all that theory is just used to analyze the incentives of politicians, bureaucrats, voters, special interest groups. So it's the application of economics to the study of political decision making.
All right. So somehow she takes from this and from extremely thin to non-existent to outright invented evidence that Buchanan had a master plan to do what? I mean, what is the sinister thing that he's up to?
Yeah, the book, if you read between the lines, it kind of reads like a James Bond novel where this sinister person, James Buchanan, plots to destroy America. And I don't know, I guess that's very common on the left. Everything is conspiracy theory. It's really, when I was reading this, it was Marxism through and through, because the Marxists never really made a serious attempt to engage their opponents in debate. They would name call that you're a capitalist tool, things like that. So this is just a different version of the old you're a capitalist tool argument of 20th century Marxism, really. And as far as Buchanan is concerned, it's she starts out with a weird stretch. You start reading the book, and there's this big, long-winded discussion of the resistance to desegregation in Virginia in the 1960s. And it's one big post hoc ergo propter hoc fallacy is what it is. You know, after this, therefore because of this. The rooster crows in the morning, the sun comes up in the morning, therefore the rooster crowing caused the sun to come up in the morning. And I'm reading this wondering, why is she talking page after page about desegregation and Brown versus Board of Education? Well, she wants to say that Buchanan got to the University of Virginia in the 60s. There was resistance to desegregation in Virginia in the 60s. Therefore, Buchanan must have had something to do with it, not only something, but a lot to do with it. And she tries to make the argument that his invention along with Gordon Tullock of the public choice school was really a veiled attempt to support opposition to desegregation, which is preposterous on its face. One of the other reviews, I think it was Phil Magnus' review of this book, points out that the late great William H. Hutt was invited by James Buchanan to spend several years at the University of Virginia during this time. And Hutt had just spent 30 years at the University of Cape Town in South Africa as the most outspoken and most famous opponent, intellectual opponent of apartheid in South Africa. And so this is not the kind of man, Buchanan, that would conceivably have anything to do with this plot that McLean claims he was a part of.
Yeah, that I thought that was an excellent point. And I also wonder if Hutt even figures in the book, if there's even an index entry form. I would bet not.
No, I don't think so.
Yeah. So that's fairly revealing, I would say. But then also Phil digs up other stuff, too. Like, for example, she's talking about the Vanderbilt agrarians and Donald Davidson in particular, and takes for granted these are terrible segregationist, racist people, and that this is where Buchanan is getting a lot of his inspiration. But it turns out in his 20 volumes of published work, there's not one solitary reference to these people. Davidson apparently used the word Leviathan. So when Buchanan uses the word Leviathan, he must have gotten that from Davidson, even though most people would realize he got it from Hobbes, especially given in his collected works, there are many, many scores of references to Hobbes. Right. Likewise, she says that he was influenced by Calhoun, which nothing wrong with. Even I show in my nullification book, even the abolitionists freely mentioned him and cited him by name in support of their justification for nullifying the Fugitive Slave Act. So there's no real problem there. But again, Calhoun is not mentioned anywhere in his 20 volumes. So she makes the stuff up. Where else would she get it from? And meanwhile, she's being praised all over the place. So anyway, so is Hutt in the index?
Yeah, Hutt is in the index in one page, but it's only mentioned that, you know, she got a list of visiting scholars to the University of Virginia, to the Thomas Jefferson Center for Political Economy, which James Buchanan founded. And she just merely lists his name, and she doesn't say anything.
I bet she doesn't know who he is.
No, she obviously doesn't know. If she does know who he is, she's very dishonest, because he was a famous anti-apartheid activist who James Buchanan brought to the University of Virginia right in the middle of the resistance to desegregation in the state of Virginia. And so you would think that Buchanan would have had a lot of severe criticism of that by the segregationists in Virginia, who if they knew about this and if they knew anything about who William Hutt was.
Right. So there's no third option. Either she knows full well and is just a liar by omission, or she is ignorant, and neither one reflects particularly well on her. Now, for whatever merits Buchanan has, from our point of view, we also need to point out that when she's going to portray him as a boogeyman who's not only really engaged in a veiled effort to maintain segregation and white supremacy. I mean, the absurdity of this, I can hardly even say this with a straight face. But beyond that, it's not like he's just trying to make sure that the rich can hang on to all their stuff. There are some proposals by Buchanan that are quite scandalous to a lot of libertarians.
Oh, yeah. You know, like I said, James Buchanan was my professor in graduate school, and I knew him very, very well. I knew most of his writings that I read. And one of the and I actually published an article in the Review of Austrian Economics years ago that mentioned and a few other journal articles criticizing him for his view on inheritance. Buchanan was in favor of heavy taxes on inheritance. Bringing back laws of primogeniture, that is, the oldest son gets everything. And it was in the rent-seeking literature. He wrote an article in the Journal of Law and Economics years ago arguing that if there's a large amount of wealth that's going to the children when mom and dad pass on, then the children will spend endless hours being nice to mom and dad, trying to be the one that gets the lion's share of the inheritance. And I thought that was sort of morally dubious to begin with. And also, I thought the economics of it was bad also. But Buchanan always had this thing. I heard him say many times how resentful he was of the fact that in World War II, when he went into the Navy, that all the plum positions were given to the Ivy Leaguers, and he had this degree from Middle Tennessee State University, and he was discriminated against. And that seems to stick with him until the day he died, this resentment of the wealthy, the Rockefellers of the world. And so he was anything but a libertarian on that issue.
I also find in David Gordon's discussion of this book that, first of all, what's great about David Gordon's reviews is that he digs up every little error all through the book. Like, you and I know that well, reading a lot of his reviews over the years, because he knows everything, so he digs up every tiny little thing. So nothing ever gets by him. So he points out that these are just almost throwaway lines in the book. But, for instance, she makes an offhand remark about John Stuart Mill supposedly being a big supporter of public education, when the fact is you can just read in On Liberty that although he favors, he wants parents to educate their children, he was an outspoken foe of public education. So there's simple, basic things that you would expect somebody to know if you're going to write a book like this. She doesn't seem to know. But also that Buchanan, although he does like private schools, he also does argue that you can make a case for public funding of education, of public education. And David also digs out a passage where redistribution of wealth can be made acceptable to Buchanan. So there's a lot of stuff that seems to run counter to how she's trying to portray him. In fact, David digs up an article called Equal Treatment and Reverse Discrimination. And in there, Buchanan says that even in the absence of discrimination, as usually defined, acceptance of the equal treatment criterion or precept for justice is sufficient to provide a possible basis for what is often referred to erroneously as reverse discrimination. So he's not even prepared completely to rule out the possibility of affirmative action. This is not, I don't remember George Wallace saying that he favored affirmative action. I don't remember a lot of these people saying that. So again, in order to make this case for Buchanan, you simply have to leave out things he said and wrote.
Right. I don't think she's capable of reading. She's a historian. A lot of what Buchanan wrote, because it was part philosophy, part economics, and she was lazy about it, obviously. Another thing she says repeatedly in the book is that the whole public choice literature is void of empirical testing, which is what is done in all the rest of the economics profession. She says over and over again that the rent-seeking literature there is not based on facts. It's just a bunch of storytelling, and which is preposterous nonsense. That's why Buchanan won the Nobel Prize in 1986, is that public choice had gone mainstream, and that by that time there had been literally thousands of econometric tests of all sorts of hypotheses in the field of public choice. I write in my review that as a graduate student, I sat in on every single public choice seminar. They were held every once a week for 3 years, and at least 90% of all the papers presented by professors from all over the world had some kind of empirical test attached to it. That was the method in those days. And I mentioned in my review, all she had to do to learn that, while she spent weeks in Buchanan's office on George Mason University's campus, was to pick up one copy of Public Choice off of his bookshelf and look at a couple of the articles. And she would have seen that it's unequivocally false, that there's no empirical, no data or facts involved in it. But so I think she's just being dishonest here. She had to have known that.
I'd like to read maybe my favorite passage from your review, and then get you to comment on it. It's a lengthy passage, but folks, you're going to enjoy this one. This is unvarnished Tom DiLorenzo right here. In Nancy McLean's mind, there's nothing wrong with America's government establishment employing vast resources, educating people how to use the levers and processes of government to expand its size, scope, powers, and budgets. This is accomplished today with the help of the vast university system, which has become one giant taxpayer-financed think tank for statism, with only a handful of exceptions, through a mainstream media that seems every bit as propagandistic as Pravda was during the Cold War, hundreds of thousands of government bureaucrats at all levels of government, every one of which is a propagandist slash lobbyist for bigger government, a K-12 school system that is thoroughly embedded with leftist political correctness, huge armies of political consultants, lobbyists, and paid propagandists, a popular culture that endlessly repeats anti-capitalist, anti-libertarian, and pro-statist themes, and thousands of government-funded nonprofit organizations from the AARP to the Wilderness Society that promote more interventionism and less freedom. On top of that are private foundations like Ford, Carnegie, and Rockefeller that have showered leftist academics with foundation grants for decades, not to mention the contributions of socialistic billionaires like George Soros, Ted Turner, and Bill Gates. For years, the Capital Research Center in Washington, D.C. published an annual study entitled Patterns of Corporate Philanthropy that documented that for every $1 corporate foundations gave to a conservative or libertarian organization, between $2 and $3 was given to a left-of-center group. Now, this is a rather important point if we're going to balance out the hysteria of Nancy McLean about a couple of foundations and a couple of billionaires in the libertarian camp, when the vast majority of absolutely every other aspect of American society is in her camp. Which goes to show the totalitarian mindset of people on that side, that when 98% of something is for them and 2% is somewhat against them, their every waking moment is consumed by crushing, humiliating, and lying about that 2%.
That's exactly right. It's all about censorship, Tom. And coming from a political operative, you know, a Paul Bagala or somebody like that, you expect these characters to be in favor of destroying the opposition. But Nancy McLean is an academic. She's supposed to be an intellectual. And what this is an attempt to censor opposing viewpoints, but with name calling, this phony association with opposition to desegregation in the 1960s, it's an attempt at censorship. And of course, that's what political correctness is all about, is to censor all opposing viewpoints. And so this book is just yet another attempt at censorship of opposing viewpoints to the socialistic left, dressed up as scholarship. You know, she lists in the back dozens and dozens of archives and references, and there are hundreds of footnotes. So on the outside, it looks very scholarly. But when you get down to it, when you read it, it really is just another attempt at political correctness run amok.
Is there anything of value in the book, in your opinion? Is there anything that you yourself either learned or thought, well, she really did get this guy good?
At the end of my review, I talk about, the last several chapters she looks at the Koch, Charles Koch and the Koch Foundation. And of course, that's her conspiracy theory, was that somehow these two men, James Buchanan and Charles Koch, got together to plot, to destroy America. But she talks a lot about, and she got, you know, she sat in Buchanan's office in George Mason. It had apparently been abandoned, and all his files were there, not in any order. And she seems to have done a good job of going through all of them, very meticulously. And she found out a letter, some interesting gossip. She found a letter that Buchanan wrote in September 17th, 1998, to Richard Fink, who at the time was the head of the Koch Foundation. And I arrived at George Mason University early in my career, the same year that Richard Fink did. He was an assistant professor, as I was, in 1981. And so I knew Richie, as he was known, I've known him all these years. And then he left academe and became Charles Koch's right-hand man for his foundation. But this letter that he found in Buchanan's signature said, quote, and I'm quoting Buchanan to Richard Fink, "Quite frankly, I am pissed off. What is being done under his name," Buchanan wrote, he said, quote, "verges on fraud and surely at a minimum amounts to exploitation of you, and of the James Buchanan Center." He was talking about a $10 million grant that the Koch Foundation gave to George Mason University to create this James Buchanan Center. And what James Buchanan was upset about was that a lot of the resources were being used basically to pay lobbyists, apparently corporate lobbyists who were not even academics, to put on seminars for Capitol Hill staffers and congresspeople and others to try to spread these ideas to them. And I think Buchanan was very upset over the fact that there was nothing really academically oriented to this whole scheme, and they were just using his name for it. And he did not like that, and he retired shortly after that and just left and went back to his farm in Blacksburg, Virginia. And there was another letter that she ran across. This was on the late Charles Rowley's blog. And Charles was an old friend of mine. I was at George Mason University in the 80s. And James Buchanan brought Charles Rowley to George Mason from England because he was a prominent public choice and law and economics scholar at the time. And on his blog, he quotes him saying, Charles Rowley saying that Richie Fink, Charles Koch's top strategist, was, quote, "a third-rate political hack and a man who is very appropriately named." And so some of these people who I respected, James Buchanan and Charles Rowley, were very upset with how Richard Fink and Charles Koch had sort of bastardized the George Mason University programs there in their name. Not that there aren't a lot of good scholars there; there are, but I think Charles made a good point here, and that was an eye opener to me that she actually found those letters.
Yeah, I found that part. That was what I was driving at with the question. I found that part of your review interesting, and I think I had heard it from somebody else. Let me add something that Jeff Deist said. Did you happen to see his blog post on this, by the way?
Yes, I did.
Okay, because he makes the point that, of course, everybody in that orbit is up in arms about this book, rightfully so. But these folks who are so upset that there'd be somebody who could just, on the basis of almost nothing, right, come up with this bizarre theory and smear all kinds of people. It's funny that they're not quite as outraged about the way the Mises Institute is treated, because they're the ones doing this to the Mises Institute. These very people who are upset at Nancy McLean are constantly accusing the Mises Institute of all kinds of wickedness on the basis of nothing. In fact, these people have never, in my opinion, they've never visited the Mises blog, because all the things I heard that the Mises Institute supposedly believed all during the presidential campaign and where the Mises Institute's loyalties supposedly were contradicted every single day on that blog without fail. Every single day they were contradicted. So these people are absolutely making things up that it takes one mouse click to refute. And they do this constantly. They've done it to me. They've done it to you. They've done it to Lou Rockwell. Some of the braver ones have sheepishly even done it to Ron Paul. That it just, it's amazing what they get away with. And then I'm not saying they therefore deserve what Nancy McClain is doing. You would think this would be a moment for them to stop and think, you know, maybe smearing people for no good reason is a bad practice, but yeah. I'm not optimistic enough that that's going to happen.
Yeah, probably not. Probably not. You and I have put up with this for years and years now, Tom, and it's kind of disgusting. And it's not everybody, of course. I don't know, you're not naming names, but it's a small subset of people there that, if I were to guess where this comes from, is that, they see the Mises Institute and Ron Paul, for that matter, as competitors. I heard a good friend of ours said that he heard a good reliable source that Charles Koch himself was outraged and extremely upset at Ron Paul's success and his popularity when he ran for president, because here he was spending hundreds of millions of dollars all these years on all these organizations with nothing to show for it, really. And then Ron Paul comes along, just gives a lot of very articulate speeches and gets millions of people behind him. And so I wouldn't be surprised if there was some sort of wink-wink going on between Fink and the Koch Foundation and some of the people who are on their payroll to smear competitors like us. And they know full well what they're doing. They know that they're lying. And they really do the same sort of sleazy thing that the Southern Poverty Law Center does. They'll say, well, there's somebody at the Mises Institute who wrote something in favor of decentralized government. Whether it's nullification or anything like that. And then they'll say, well, John C. Calhoun also said something similar to this, and he was a slavery defender. Therefore, they must be secret slavery defenders. That's the sort of thing that I call the Soviet Poverty Lie Center does. And some of the people associated with the Cato Institute and the Beltway Libertarians and even George Mason have done the same thing, as you say.
Yeah. Now, as you say, we know some people in this orbit who are okay and who don't do these things, but man, the idea that, I mean, look, you look at what you've written, Tom, and what I've written about economics, about liberty, all these topics. It is exceptionally implausible that I would hold all those views. However, the one exception that I make to liberty is I favor chattel slavery. I mean, that makes no sense at all. So they, of course, they know that's ridiculous. There's nobody favors slavery in the year 2017. They know that. And they they sound like the Southern Poverty Law Center, these so-called libertarians. They do this to us as a way of virtue signaling to the mainstream media that, we're libertarians, we're a little out of the mainstream, but we're not like those people.
Yeah. Well, a lot of these people are not really libertarians. They're libertines. And they define freedom very differently than the traditional definition of freedom that a Murray Rothbard or even a Thomas Jefferson would say, as far as freedom goes. They look at it as a license. You're supposed to be an advocate of their lifestyle, and so if you don't toe that line, they seem to hate you. And so, but like you said, there are some good people. I've been using the textbook by Tyler Cowen and Alex Tabarrok at George Mason for about 10 years, the Principles of Economics book. So, it's not everybody associated with them, but it's some people.
Well, Tom, let me ask you something a little bit different then. If somebody wanted to read a history of, let's say, the libertarian movement, just to try to get a sense of who the people were and what happened and how it came about, that was written by somebody more even-handed, is there one that you can recommend? Is there any good one? If not, should there be?
There really should be. I can't, off the top of my head, Murray Rothbard's name always comes first when you talk about that, because there's so much about the history of libertarian ideas. And just reading his essay, Anatomy of the State, will give you a good idea of where these ideas come from. But I think that book has yet to be written about that, because, it goes back. Lord Acton was a historian of liberty in the 19th century. And so as far as the history of these ideas, that book I don't think has been written yet.
Yeah. So there, if we have young folks out there thinking, what can I do? Everything's already been written. We don't even have a decent history of our movement, really. I mean, I can think of one or two titles, but they have flaws in them. We don't even have a district. And secondly, with all the papers and publications of Murray Rothbard, it's scandalous that we don't have a really sophisticated biography of Rothbard.
Yeah, well, I guess we'll have to put Guido Holzman to work on that.
Yeah, I know. I think he's retired from that. After that Mises project, he's probably retired from that. But yeah, we sure have the sources and the papers for it. Well, anyway, I'll link to Nancy MacLean's book, why not, at tomwoods.com/954 if people would like to take a look at it. Don't buy it, of course, but if you want to flip through it at the library or something, have a look and you can see that we are not making this stuff up. And I'm also going to link to Tom's just absolutely epic takedown that I was waiting for. And man, it did not disappoint, Tom. So thanks for doing that. And I'm looking forward to seeing you next week.
Okay, Tom, we'll see you in Auburn, Alabama, our libertarian mecca on Sunday.
Absolutely. All right. Before I tell you what I got coming up for you, let me tell you about a website created by a listener of the show called chefssteel.com. So it's chefs with an S and then steel. So there are going to be two S's in a row. Chefssteel.com. The site is a work in progress, but it's designed for people who are really serious about what they do in the kitchen. And it's designed to help you decide what you should get. For example, knives. What's the best kitchen knife set? What would be the best Japanese chef knives? Things like that are covered on this site. So instead of spending your whole life trying to figure this out, you just go to chefssteel.com. So it's just getting started, but check it out. I'm going to link to it at tomwoods.com/954. And remember, you get a really nice bonuses from me if you use my link when you get your hosting. Check out those bonuses, including free publicity, which is your biggest fear, that tumbleweeds are going to go by when you announce that your website is now open for business. Well, forget that. We're going to blast those tumbleweeds out to, I don't know, Arizona or something when your site opens up, because we're going to send some Tom Woods Show traffic over to you. How do you get that? Check it out at tomwoods.com/publicity. All right, let's see. Tomorrow we're talking about a historical episode, not really an episode, I guess, a period, a place, Genoa in Italy. We think we know all about the history of the Italian city-states and their ideology, but there's an interesting exception to the rule that is going to be a valuable historical lesson for libertarians. So that's tomorrow. And then the next day, so episode 956, I'm bringing David Gordon back on, who's read pretty much every book there is. And I asked him, tell me the five books you would urge libertarians to read. And it's not going to be the usual economics in one lesson. That's fine. I'm nothing against economics in one lesson. It's a lovely, wonderful book. But we've all heard it recommended 800 million times. David has recommended some books, a couple of them I have not read, and I'm Mr. Daily Podcast guy. So you're going to enjoy that. And I got other fun stuff coming up. I mean, don't forget, I got a bonus episode coming up over the weekend about progressive rock. So you can just skip over all these other episodes and just wait for that one. Anyway, before I say anything even more ridiculous than that, I better sign off for today. Thanks for listening.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.